Intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
Great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, here we are, 7th day of May in the year of 2021, and dare to think out loud. Just dare to think, people. Give it a shot. You know, it really doesn't hurt that bad. I know it gets in the way of your emotions, but let's give it a shot. Just once, try it. Who knows? You might like thinking instead of feeling. Brings me back to that old thought that emotion without reason is the devil's playground. Love that quote. Well, here we are today, and I have my good friends, Dave Scorpio from down south of the equator, and Cal Robbins out in the wonderful desert southwest of Arizona, but he's sitting there on Lake Havasu, so it's not quite so bad. Cal, how are you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing good today, Mike. It's starting to become summer now. It was over 70 degrees for the overnight low last night, so it's warming up real well out here.
All right. That sounds pleasant to hear in Iowa, where I am temporarily, because for the next 3 days, we're supposed to be in the upper 30s for a low each night. So a little bit of a cold snap. Brother Dave Scorpio, how about telling the folks about how they can contribute to keeping this platform for free speech alive, please, sir? And tell them how you're doing.
Okay, well, Brother Mike, I'm doing good. You know, it's becoming clear to everyone that free speech is being attacked more and more every day. The so-called nonsense about community guidelines really just means contradicting government narratives. So everyone come aboard and help out this bastion of free speech. Come on, Freedom Slips. That's freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Become a Patreon member. get what you can every month. And because, you know, none of the hosts are making money. The management works for free, too. And it's all basically a labor of love. All the expenses go to just keeping the servers going and the expenses of the station. Also, there's a Zazzle store. You can buy cool T-shirts, hats, even shoes with original artwork on it. Or go to the very bottom of the front page, and there is a way, an address there, where you can mail in donations the old-fashioned way with snail mail. So come aboard and help us out, guys. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Dave. As for the subject today, I'll give you a little bit of background. At one time, and I think I even mentioned it to Cal, that we would try to each Friday to take an anti-federalist and delve into their thoughts and their writings as well as possible. But then I was sitting around thinking, and I thought to myself, hey, Gaddy, what kind of nut are you to believe that you could even begin to scratch the surface of people like Patrick Henry, Samuel Bryan, Robert Yates, and many others? What makes you think you could even begin to scratch the surface of what those people were about in 2 hours? I believe an in-depth study, you could spend 2 months, 2 hours a day on just Patrick Henry and still not get the subject covered well. But anyway, today I have decided that what I want to do is to parse Brutus and only parse one of Brutus's essays. And I believe that you can, taken paragraph by paragraph, we might be able to better understand Brutus and exactly what he was getting at. And so we will do that. But first of all, I would like to put some background behind this, because, you know, there is some speculation about who Brutus actually was. Some believe that it was George Clinton, and others believe that it was Robert Yates. But the evidence pretty well indicates, and especially from the writing, if you're familiar with these people, if you just sit and read them once, you're probably not going to have an idea who it was. But reading Brutus, I am almost positive that it was Robert Yates. And who was Robert Yates? He was selected along with John Lansing Jr. and Alexander Hamilton as the three delegates from the state of New York to attend the Constitutional Convention in 1787. And the only state, New York was the only state, that the majority of the delegates were what became known as the Anti-Federalists. But, and ironically, very most likely, and I think this is very indicative, is the integrity of Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. was above reproach. And I'm not sure, except for maybe George Mason and Elbridge Gerry and Luther Martin, that could be said for most anyone who attended the Constitutional Convention. And they were very open with it. And in late June or early July, after their fellow delegate, Alexander Hamilton, had made an overt pitch for a monarchical form of government. I mean, he really wanted it full out monarchy, just like King George, but with another King George, Washington, running the show. But that didn't work. And so Lansing and Robert Yates became disgusted. All right, why did they become disgusted and leave the Constitutional Convention? Before I get into that, I would like to make the point that when two of the three delegates left the Constitutional Convention in early July, New York no longer had a vote. So that made Again, that is another reaffirmation of the fact that the Constitution was fraudulent. Because in effect at that time was the Articles of Confederation. They had not been replaced. The Articles of Confederation were still in place, and which required Article 13 required that every state agree to any proceedings moving forward. Well, Rhode Island didn't show up. So that's the first thing that made it illegal, other than the fact of quite a few other things, but that's the one that is most predominant. So it was illegal from the get-go because all 13 states weren't represented. And then when the two of the three delegates from New York left, that means there were two states that weren't represented. So Yates and Lansing wrote a letter to Governor Clinton when they left. And that is such a critical letter. So I'm going to read that letter first. So I indulge upon you to listen, and we'll kind of parse that letter, gentlemen, if you don't mind, before we get into Brutus, because I think this is critical. So here is the letter written by John Lansing Jr. and Robert Yates to Governor Clinton upon leaving the Constitutional Convention. Sir, we do ourselves the honor to advise Your Excellency that in pursuance of concurrent resolutions of the Honorable Senate and Assembly, we have, together with Mr. Hamilton, attended the convention appointed for revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting amendments to the same. Well, if we parse that first paragraph, we would have to say that what they're saying is that the Senate and the House in the state of New York elected them, along with Hamilton, to attend the convention in Philadelphia. But they were appointed specifically for revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting amendments to the same back to that legislative body. So first of all, we have to understand that here is another point of contention and another point of the fraud is the fact, very simply, that the people at that convention were not authorized to write a new constitution by anyone. They took it upon themselves to do so. Going to the second paragraph, it is with the sincerest concern we observe that in the prosecution of the important objects of our mission, we have been reduced to the disagreeable alternative of either exceeding the powers delegated to us and giving our assent to measures which we conceive destructive to the political happiness of the citizens of the United States, or opposing our opinions to that of a body of respectable men to whom those citizens had given the most unequivocal proofs of confidence. Thus circumstanced, under these impressions, to have hesitated would have to have been culpable. We therefore gave the principles of the Constitution, which has received the sanction of a majority of the convention, our decided and unreserved dissent. But we must candidly confess that we should have been equally opposed to any system, however modified, which had in object the consolidation of the United States into one government. Now, that's the end of that paragraph. Cal, what are your thoughts on the paragraph and the reason that Mr. Lansing and Mr. Yates gave for leaving the convention?
Well, they're saying that they left the convention because what's going on at the convention exceeds powers delegated to them. The convention or the delegates at the convention, the Federalists, are wanting to consolidate the governments into one single government. In other words, it would take away the sovereignty of the states, and they saw that coming. And so instead of doing that, they left. They did the honorable thing and left the convention, not to participate in the fraud.
Well, I really like...
Wait, they didn't participate in the fraud, yet everybody still votes and participates in the fraud. Let me think about that. Oh, well, go ahead.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I like what they said. We had a choice. And they called it a disagreeable alternative. And they said we can either exceed the powers delegated to us, which everybody else at the convention did. They said we could either assent to the measures which we conceive destructive to the political happiness of the citizens of the United States. So what they're saying is that the Constitution was going to be disagreeable and destructive to the citizens of the United States. And they either had to make that decision or opposing our opinions to that of a body of respectable men. Now they're talking about Washington and Franklin here, more than anyone else, to whom those citizens had given the most unequivocal proofs of confidence. Here's another indictment. They are very subtly, which they were very good at, have said, look, the you gentlemen who have left, who have stayed there, who are still at the convention, you are violating the confidence of the people who sent you there. And then they say, thus circumstanced under these impressions, to have hesitated would have been to be culpable. So they said, if we had stayed like you are, then we would have been guilty. Said, we therefore gave the principles of this Constitution, which has received the sanction of a majority of the convention. Notice they said majority. But yet when the gentleman sent this to the states, they said it was unanimous. Another deception that people aren't aware of. And then they said that we give it our decided and unreserved dissent. So they're totally opposed to this Constitution. And then they said, but we must candidly confess that we should have been equally opposed to any system, however modified, which had in object the consolidation of the United States into one government. So they were saying, even if they would have stuck to the rules of amending the articles and had amended the articles to make the consolidation, to create a consolidation of the United States into one government, they would have opposed that as well. Now, Dave, you're a history guy. You had that stuff in college. Was this ever discussed in college?
Oh, no, absolutely not. And, you know, it's just so interesting that the whole thing was born in secrecy with, shades put over the windows, a vow of secrecy amongst the guys at the convention. And it's interesting, the quote you were reading, just how this guy knew that consolidating all this into one government would certainly lead to problems, the very problems that caused the revolution in the first place, especially when you combine it with the power of a central bank that the infiltrator Alexander Hamilton was pushing for since the very inception of the government.
Oh, very well stated, Dave. Then I will jump to the next paragraph. And it says, we beg leave, briefly, to state some cogent reasons which, among others, influenced us to decide against a consolidation of the states. These are reducible into two heads. First, the limited and well-defined powers under which we acted, and which could not, on any possible construction, embrace an idea of such magnitude as to assent to a general constitution in subversion of that of the state. To me, this is dramatic. What they are saying is if we would have agreed to this, we would have been betraying the people of our state who sent us here. It would have been the subversion of their home state. Now, I think that is absolutely beautiful because they point out that everyone who stayed, everyone who signed this thing, all of these Federalists betrayed their home states. They were, in effect, traitors to their home states by relinquishing the power that the people of their states held in government and turning it over to a central authority. Cal, any thoughts on that first one?
No, you explained that perfectly. I don't think it could be explained any better than what you just did, Mike.
Well, thank you, my friend. Moving on to the second one. It says, a conviction of the impracticability of establishing a general government pervading every part of the United States and extending essential benefits to all. Wow. Then he goes on to explain, or they go on to explain, our powers were explicit and confined to the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting such alterations and provisions therein as should render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union. Again, he says, our powers were explicit. There was no wiggle room. These people were not sent there to create a new constitution. Their powers were explicit. Once they've stepped outside of that, they were violating the law. That is why when Samuel Bryan, writing a sentinel, said this was a criminal conspiracy, he was exactly right. What they did in Philadelphia was a criminal conspiracy because it was planned by several of the Federalists before they got there. The letters between people like Madison, Jay, Washington, Edmund Randolph, and others proved this unequivocally. Any thoughts on that, Cal?
No, like you say, the letters between exchanged between the Federalists prior to the convention, they definitely show that there was a conspiracy to basically overthrow the government, the existing government, the Articles of Confederation. It was, I don't know, tantamount to treason to overthrow the existing government. Isn't that what that's called? Treason? It's a coup anyway. A revolution or a coup of some sort, a bloodless coup.
Well, you know, think how unique that was. Okay, we're going to overthrow the government. And we're right off, we're going to give you a new constitution that you're going to like. That is basically what they said. I'm going to now jump to the next paragraph. And then we will, parse that.
Well, Mike, can I ask you a quick question?
Please do, Dave.
Yeah. I think the term criminal conspiracy is extremely accurate and descriptive of what happened, but say Thomas Jefferson, what were his thoughts on the possible maliciousness of what was going on? Did he have any statements on that?
As best I can understand, and throughout my research, Dave, the only person who was writing to Jefferson on any extensive level about the convention was James Madison. And James Madison was flavoring the Constitution, the adoption of the Constitution, in his letters to Jefferson. But you must remember, and most people don't think about this, they certainly didn't have email or telephones back then, Jefferson was in France. So Madison had to write a letter, postmark it, get it to a ship headed for France. The ship had to get all the way to France. Jefferson answered, and then you had to reverse the process. So you're talking not about hours, minutes, or days, you're talking about months. And if you read the letters from Madison to Jefferson about what was going on, he doesn't tell Jefferson that they were pushing for a monarchy. He doesn't tell Jefferson they were trying to destroy the states. He revealed that to his co-conspirators in his letters, but not to Jefferson. So I don't think Jefferson was aware of the extent of what was happening in any way, shape, form, or fashion.
Well, that's very interesting that he revealed it to his conspirators, but not to Jefferson. Very, very interesting.
Well, I found it that way as well, Dave.
Mike?
Yes,
Mike,
sir.
When Madison was writing these letters, this was during the convention?
Yes.
Although, even though Madison is sworn to secrecy?
Yes.
Okay. Just, you know, just getting it clear in my head. So, well, Madison was violating that on oath that he wanted.
Well, to them, it didn't make any difference. To the Federalist rules, you know, if they were there in a conspiracy, they didn't care about violating the rules. That was obvious. And you have to remember that Alexander Hamilton left this convention on 5 separate occasions, which I can document, and went back to New York. And I believe, can't prove it, but I believe he was back there conferring with people of the Bank of London, or Bank of England, I'm sorry. I believe he was conferring with international bankers when he went back to New York. But when he went back to New York, he was writing letters back to Washington and Rufus King and Gouverneur Morris. He was writing letters back to them. And in one of those letters, he alludes to getting back to the convention in time, what I believe what he was saying, because there is something I need to take care of with the writing of the Constitution. And I'm sure he was coming back to include the necessary and proper clause, because he's been gone 5 times, and yet he is put on the Committee of Style and Arrangement with his friend Gouverneur Morris. And there is no record of the necessary and proper clause being debated at any time in the Committee of the Whole. And I believe that the evidence is clear that that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 was added by the Committee of Style in whole. That it was not the creation of the committee of all of the delegates together. And Hamilton writing back to them, Hamilton going somewhere else to discuss what was going on at the convention was a violation of their oath. But to these people involved in a criminal conspiracy, we can't expect them. I think it just further condemns them to their own crime, is the fact that it didn't bother them to write to other people. And to contrast that, thanks for bringing it up, Cal, to contrast that with what was told to Luther Martin. And Luther Martin wrote about this. Luther Martin was told when he said, okay, when they started bringing stuff up, he said, well, I want to consult with my fellow Marylanders. I want to talk with the people back home in Maryland. I want to converse with them, which wasn't that far away. And he was told immediately, no, you can't do that. And Luther Martin wrote and that he actually said, it's in the letter, he said, I said to the group, am I to believe that all of the intelligence in this entire country is centered only in this room? I am not allowed to consult with the people who actually sent me here? That, again, to me, is a terrible indictment of the whole process. Because if they had not been trying, if what they were trying to give to the people was good and helpful and beneficial, why would they hide it? That's just a question. I think the indictment is clear here about it being a criminal conspiracy and a fraud of a huge magnitude. But jumping now to their next paragraph. They say, from these expressions, we were led to believe that a system of consolidated government could not in the remotest degree have been in the contemplation of the legislature of this state. For that so important a trust as the adopting measures which tended to deprive the state governments of its most essential rights of sovereignty and to place it in a dependent situation could not have been confided by implication, and the circumstance that the acts of the convention were to receive a state approbation in the last resort forcibly corroborated the opinion that our powers could not involve the subversion of a constitution. And they're talking about their state constitution. The subversion of a constitution, which being immediately derived from the people, could only be abolished by their express consent and not by a legislature possessing authority vested in them for its preservation. Man, what a statement. Nor could we suppose that if it had been the intention of the legislature to abrogate the existing Confederation, they would, in such pointed terms, have directed the attention of their delegates to the revision and amendment of it in total exclusion of every other idea. Guys, there is so much in that paragraph. It is just absolutely unreal. But what they're saying, and to parse it, is that a system of consolidated government could not in any, as they say, remotest degree have been in the contemplation of the legislature of this state. So what they're saying is the legislature that sent us here, the legislature that elected the three of us, even in the remotest idea, could not have sent us here to destroy the powers of our state. Now, do you think that, Cal, do you think that any state that sent their delegates to that convention expected their delegates to go there and trade away the sovereignty of the state that sent them there?
No, not the legislatures as a whole, I'm sure. In some of the states, they were starting to, their legislatures were starting to be dominated by Federalists. And yeah, those Federalists and parts of certain state legislatures were kind of in on the game and participated in it, but apparently not in Maryland at all. Or not Maryland, excuse me, this is New York, not in New York at all. It was still pretty much anti-Federalist state, right, state sovereignty state at that time.
Well, just imagine, guys, let's say that Cal and Dave, let's say that we have an organization, the three of us. It's an organization that we have, we control. We do, you know, things together, you know, we work together, we do these things together, we create things together, and you guys say, okay, hey, Mike, we want to send you to this conference of like-minded people, and we want you to go there and represent our interest at this meeting. What kind of person would I be if I went to that meeting and sold every power you had to another group of people? That's exactly what happened here. And they are, in this letter to the governor, they are outlining this so beautifully. And it says, our powers could not involve the subversion of our constitution, state constitution, which being immediately derived from the people could only be abolished by their express consent. So in other words, if we're going to abolish the constitution of our state to give the powers over to the federal government, then that should be done by the people of the state of New York and not even by our legislature. And then they said, nor could we suppose that if it had been the intention of the legislature to abrogate the existing confederation, they would, in such pointed terms, have directed the attention of their delegates to the revision and amendment of it in total exclusion of every other idea. So what they were saying was, hey, guys, you know, if you had intended for us to have created this entire new constitution and have done away with the powers of our state, why would you have told us to come here and amend the Articles of Confederation? Why would you not have said, guys, go create a new document giving away the powers of our state to a centralized government? So then moving on to the next paragraph, they said, reasoning in this manner, we are of the opinion that the leading feature of every amendment ought to be the preservation of the individual states in their uncontrolled constitutional rights, and that in reversing these, a mode might have been devised of granting to the Confederacy the monies arising from a general system of revenue, the power of regulating commerce and enforcing the observance of foreign treaties, and other necessary matters of less moment. So what they're saying there is what they were originally sent there to do, to preserve the rights of the people of the state of New York, and then to devise a way to grant to the Union the monies arising from a general system of revenue, the power of regulating commerce, enforcing the observance of foreign treaties and other necessary matters of less moment, which means less important powers. So thoughts on that one, Cal?
It was a general consensus and even admitted to by many of the anti-federalists that, yeah, this Articles of Confederation, we do need to fix the revenue stream, so to speak. And you know, Patrick Henry addresses it really well in the Virginia ratification that, you know, I agree. We need to have some form of general revenue stream. And they were looking at tariffs and imposts and excises to handle the expenses of the general system of government. And once you have just that little bit of monies coming in, that limits how big that federal government would be. So that's what they were looking at.
Well, they were very well said, Cal. What they were saying is let's give enough revenue to the federal government to regulate commerce and to enforce treaties with foreign countries and any other lesser items. And, you know, compare that with what we've got now with Joe Biden saying he's going to turn, collection of personal data over to private organizations, and he's going to get rid of this, he's going to get rid of that, he's going to do all of this stuff. And there are no powers in the Constitution, as bad as it is, that gives him the authority to do all of this. But this has been the natural natural transformation of the government to the point to where this is accepted.
Yeah, and Mike, I would just add that I guess if you can't have a monarchy, then a federal government is the next best thing. And we're seeing that play out in real time today. I mean, there's no question it just gets more and more tyrannical and repressive with each year.
Exactly.
They just spread the powers of a monarchy into three branches of government. The same powers of a monarch still exist.
Well, the monarchy in Britain at that time had those same three branches. Cal.
Yeah. Yes, although, they did.
But the king the king had the supreme veto.
That's a very good point. Actually, it's just different nomenclature, really.
Right. Instead of the House of Lords and the House of Commons, you have the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Exactly.
That's amazing. It's so obvious, yet most people just don't see it. It's incredible.
Well, you have to want to see it, Dave.
Yeah, that's true.
Like you have so many to not things. Want to see it.
Yeah, which is seems
it's,
to be.
It's all right. It's all right there if you look at it. If you just step back and look at it, all those powers are still right there. You know, if one branch can't exercise the power of a monarchy, the other two branches will go in concert to exercise those same powers. It's just collusion of government powers.
True. And in the next paragraph, I think they nail it pretty well. I'm skipping a few words here, but trying to get to the very root of this next paragraph. It says, we entertained an opinion that a general government or a central government, however guarded by a declaration of rights or cautionary provisions, must unavoidably in a short time be productive of the destruction of the civil liberty of such citizens who could be effectually coerced by it, by reason of the extensive territory of the United States. Now, remember, there were 13 states back then, not 57, as Obama claims. The dispersed situation of its inhabitants and the insuperable difficulty of controlling or counteracting the views of a set of men, however unconstitutional and oppressive their acts might be, possessed of all the powers of government, and who, from their remoteness from their constituents and necessary permanency of office, could not be supposed to be uniformly actuated by an attention to their welfare and happiness, that however wise and energetic the principles of the general government might be, the extremities of the United States could not be kept in due submission and obedience to its laws at the distance of many hundred miles from the seat of government. that if the general legislature was composed of so numerous a body of men as to represent the interest of all the inhabitants of the United States in the usual and true ideas of representation, the expense of supporting it would become intolerably burdensome, and that if a few only were vested with a power of legislation, the interests of a great majority of the inhabitants of the United States must necessarily be unknown, or if known, even in the first stages of the operations of the new government, unattended to. My word, these two men saw exactly what this government was going to do. They knew that a big government, where the people are sitting hundreds and today thousands of miles away from the seat of government. Does anyone out there really believe that there's anybody in Washington, D.C. that really gives a damn what we think? I don't think there's one of them there that gives a damn what we think. They prove it to us every day.
Oh yeah. It's all an illusion. And, you know, as you said, if people weren't allowed to vote, it would become so much more clear that we're dealing with a criminal enterprise. These people are interested in feathering their own nest and becoming millionaires.
Well, if they weren't millionaires, but the one thing that overtakes these people is greed. I've never seen one of them yet that said, hey, I have enough money, I'm going home.
It's an unquenchable thirst, Mike.
Well, one of the things I will always remember, and I created an enemy for life, I promise you, 2010 in Colorado, we elected a good old Republican. I say we, I didn't vote at all, but he was elected. And he replaced a lifelong Democrat. So 2010, he's elected. He's running for office again, naturally, re-election in 2012. And I showed up at one of his, local meetings. And, you know, town hall meetings. And I raised my hand, and we knew each other. And he said, as a matter of fact, he even attended one of my Constitution classes when he was running for office. Not after, but when he was running. So he's there, and I raised my hand. He said, yes, Mike, what's your question? And I said, well, you know, Scott, I have a question. I said, when you ran for Congress a little less than 18 months ago, when you first ran, you filed financial status. And at that time, you were worth, in your own report, $2.1 million. And I said, most of us here in town know that most of that was inherited from your father's business. But you had a net worth of $2.1 million. And now, today, Scott, as you're running for re-election for your second term, your net worth is listed at $11.3 million. Could you explain to the group here how your net worth increased by $9 million on a salary of $175,000 a year?
Did he explain it?
No, he did not.
Yeah, what's he going to say?
And it was kind of funny. After that, he had another town hall meeting in an adjoining county, and I went there to that meeting. And when we went in, there was a sign there that said, all questions for the congressman must be pre-approved.
Of course it did.
So jumping back to Yates and Lansing, I mean, they made it very clear here that a centralized government for 13 states would never work because you could not represent all of the people. And they said in that paragraph, if we were to put enough people there to represent the interest of everyone in the country, the financial burden to have that many representatives would be unfathomable.
Mike,
Yes, sir.
Can I also point out, they also pointed out that any general government, no matter how guarded by a Declaration of Rights or any other cautionary provisions, will unavoidably, in a short time, be productive to the destruction of liberty. So it doesn't matter what you do. If you centralize government, you're going to destroy the people's liberty. That's what they're saying. The more centralized the government, the more destruction of liberty. It just, that's how the seesaw balances itself.
Exactly.
And that, I just wanted to make, you know, this is in understanding political science and political philosophies, that's how that works.
True. And then they said, these reasons were, in our opinion, conclusive against any system of consolidated government. To that recommended by the convention, we suppose most of them very forcibly apply. So in very eloquent language there, they said that everything done by that constitution was going to fit all of the things they had described above. And then they say, it is not our intention to pursue this matter farther than merely to explain our conduct in the discharge of the trust which the honorable legislature reposed in us. Interested, however, as we are, in common with our fellow citizens, in the result, we cannot forbear to declare that we have the strongest apprehensions that a government so organized as that recommended by the convention cannot afford the security to equal and permanent liberty which we wish to make an invariable object of our pursuit. Again, Cal, they're saying this: there's no way this thing can protect the liberties of the people, because we are not present at the completion of the new Constitution, but before we left the convention, its principles were so well established as to convince us that no alteration was to be expected to conform to our ideas of expediency and safety, a persuasion that our further attendance would be fruitless and unavailing, rendering us less solicitous to return. We have thus explained our motives for opposing the adoption of the National Constitution, which we conceived it our duty to communicate to Your Excellency, to be submitted to the consideration of the Honorable Legislature. We have the honor to be, with the greatest respect, Your Excellency's most obedient and very humble servants, His Excellency Governor Clinton. So, Dave, overall view of this letter that was submitted, how would you condense that down into a nutshell for the common species known as Bumbus americanus?
Well, I think that the people involved in this knew exactly what they were doing. And as Cal said, the more you centralize government, the more you lose liberty. And I think that's probably a truism since the dawn of human history. It's looking more and more like the people involved in this. It really was a criminal conspiracy, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And so did the anti-federalists. They saw what was coming as well.
Well, is there, if we look at this and let's compare it momentarily for the rest of this hour, let's compare what Lansing Jr. and what Robert Yates said to, in comparison to what the Federalists promised in the Federalist Papers. Cal, you want to lead this off?
Oh, where to start with that? All the lies in the Federalist Papers as opposed to the truth spoken by the Anti-Federalists. But where does one begin on that one? Federalist One, and going from there, wow, that's, I don't even know where to begin with that one, Mike. That's a huge question. But I do have a question for you, Mike.
All right, whip it out.
Okay, New York was one of the most populous states, yet they only sent 3 delegates. Why did New York only send 3 delegates And what was the manner in which those delegates were chosen to attend the convention? Do you know?
Well, I know that, number one, the heavy majority of people in New York were anti-Federalist, of anti-Federalist leaning. And Governor Clinton was obviously an anti-Federalist. And I believe he weighed heavily with the legislature on picking these delegates. I can't find anything as to why they kept their number at three, but everyone knew that the vote at the convention, or at least they believe their votes at the convention, and it did happen this way, would be taken by states and not by individuals. So New York wasn't concerned, or at least Governor Clinton and the legislature wasn't concerned with how many people they sent, like Pennsylvania, which sent eight, and Maryland, which sent seven, I believe. They were not so concerned with numbers as they were with the fact they wanted to get the what they considered to be the best and the brightest. And Hamilton was able to be elected because of the political influence of his father-in-law, Philip Schuyler. And that went one of the most wealthy men in the state of New York. So that went a long way in getting Hamilton there. But not mentioned to very many people was that at this time, Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. were both members of the New York Supreme Court, which I think gives even more weight to this letter, because they mentioned the state constitution, which it was their job to uphold and enforce. So they had a little bit different outlook than a lot of the other people who were convention delegates being in that position. And shortly after the Constitution was ratified, Robert Yates was elected as the Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court. Now, these two men were very active jurists. Hamilton, being an attorney, was only busy representing Tories at this time. He was representing the people of England who had lost property during the Revolution, trying to get their property back. So I hope that answers your question. Is that is there anything I can add?
No, I was just wondering. So basically, New York sent quality over quantity, and Governor Clinton had influence, but ultimately it was the state legislatures, or the state legislature of New York, that chose to send three and sent those three delegates.
Right. Correct. That was okay. Basically their approach. Dave, what are your thoughts?
I agree with what Cal was saying. All of this is being, you know, essentially proven by what we see today, Mike. There's just no question about it.
Well, these guys, you know, of course, you know, I saw something the other day that just made me absolutely sick at my stomach. Someone on one of the crazy TV news shows, and I seldom do I ever really pay attention unless I get an email that somebody said so-and-so. And a professor on CNN, a law professor from a prominent university, was asked about some of the things that Biden was doing. And they said, is this act constitutional? And this law professor's answer just shocked me. He said, well, I'll promise you this. You won't find that listed anywhere in the Federalist Papers. They didn't ask him, what did the Federalist Papers say about it? He was asked, is it constitutional? And I think it's very telling that his immediate response was, well, it's not in the Federalist Papers. So that tells me what I have thought for many years, is that in the law schools, the Federalist Papers are what is used as the judge or the testament, if you will, that they are to adhere to, which is truly scary, because we all know, if you've spent any time at this at all, is that the Federalist Papers was a propaganda campaign to get something elected, to get the Constitution ratified, much like the rhetoric that is being used today to get people to take a vaccine. It hadn't changed. Would you find that observation correct or incorrect, Cal?
No, that observation is absolutely correct. It was the Federalist Papers were a response to the concerns raised by the anti-federalists. They were trying to convince the people of New York to ratify the Constitution because there have been so many questions posed by the anti-federalists. So exactly. Many objections, legitimate objections. If anybody actually reads the anti-federalists, I'm coming to find out most people talk about them but haven't read them. So much of what they predicted and said would happen has happened or is happening. And
right.
Even though they say it, people say, well, yeah, well, they were wrong because they ratified the Constitution anyway. It's like, yeah, and Obamacare is wrong, but it got passed as a law too. So, you right. know, come on, guys.
Well, we're about to run out of time here. Very astute observation, Cal. We're about to run out of time. And coming back on the next hour, we are going to take Brutus Essay Number 1, which was written, I believe, by Robert Yates, one of the men who left the convention. And we're going to parse that document as well. So, you know, really appreciate you folks tuning in with us today to Dare to Think Out Loud. And hope you'll come back on the flip side as we discuss Mr. Brutus. Well, let's see. Are we going to have a break here, Dave?
Should be there any minute coming up. Yeah, we're at right at the right point here.
Yeah, that's,
I don't hear the music.
Yeah, I don't either. So that's what was making me wonder. So regardless, we shall, you know, if we have to play through, we'll play through. But let's see if we do, in fact, have the break coming up. So also, Cal, while we've got a second or two here, have you read Brutus Jr.?
Yeah, I read Brutus Jr., and I'm not sure who that was. It wasn't Yates. To me, it sounds like Patrick Henry, but yeah, Brutus Jr. That's another sarcastic one like Montezuma.
Right. Exactly. Well, Dave, I don't think we're going to have a break, my friend.
It doesn't look like it because we're already at 11:58. So, yeah, it doesn't look like it's going to happen.
All right. Well, you're not going to trick me. I'm going to go right into Brutus here, I believe.
Let's keep it rolling.
All right. I believe we can handle that. So let me bring up my Brutus Number 1, and let's do a little dissecting of Brutus Number 1. Paragraph 1. Okay, to the citizens of the state of New York, when the public is called to investigate and decide upon a question in which not only the present members of the community are deeply interested, but upon which the happiness and misery of generations yet unborn is in great measure suspended, the benevolent mind cannot help feeling itself peculiarly interested in the result. That's pretty good writing there, and especially when he says that not only the current people, but the happiness and misery of generations yet unborn. I believe that's us, guys. Continuing on, Brutus says, in this situation, I trust the feeble efforts of an individual to lead the minds of the people to a wise and prudent determination cannot fail of being acceptable to the candid and dispassionate part of the community. Encouraged by this consideration, I have been induced to offer my thoughts upon the present important crisis of our public affairs. Perhaps this country never saw so critical a period in their political concerns. We have felt the feebleness of the ties by which these United States are held together and the want of sufficient energy in our present confederation to manage, in some instances, our general concerns. Various expedients have been proposed to remedy these evils, but none have succeeded. At length, a convention of the states has been assembled. They have formed a constitution which will now probably be submitted to the people to ratify or reject, who are the fountain of all power, to whom alone it of right belongs to make or unmake constitutions or forms of government at their pleasure. The most important question that was ever proposed to your decision or to the decision of any people under heaven is before you, and you are to decide upon it by men of your own election, chosen specially for this purpose. If the Constitution offered to your acceptance be a wise one, calculated to preserve the invaluable blessings of liberty, to secure the inestimable rights of mankind, and promote human happiness, then, if you accept it, you will lay a lasting foundation of happiness for millions yet unborn. Generations to come will rise up and call you blessed. You may rejoice in the prospects of this vast extended continent becoming filled with free men who will assert the dignity of human nature. You may solace yourselves with the idea that society in this favored land will fast advance to the highest point of perfection. The human mind will expand in knowledge and virtue, and the golden age be in some measure realized. But if, on the other hand, this form of government contains principles that will lead to the subversion of liberty, if it tends to establish a despotism, or what is worse, a tyrannic aristocracy, then, if you adopt it, this only remaining asylum for liberty will be shut up, and posterity will execrate your memory. Thoughts on that, Cal?
Well, he's just looking at posterity, and if this Constitution is what everybody, you know, the Federalists are saying it is, you'll be lauded as heroes. But if not, you will be condemned by history. It just took a long time for the took a long time for the tyrannical autocracy to actually make its way known and for despotism to become upon us. But hey, we're looking at it straight in the face now, and it was all created by the Constitution.
Well, would you say that in your lifetime, and I would like for both you gentlemen to expound on this, in your lifetime, has your rights and liberty increased, been protected, or been taken away? Dave, you want to go first?
Oh, well, Mike, it's in the extreme of the latter. This country's been transformed in terms of most people don't even know what liberty is. And it's just incredible the transformation I've seen just in my lifetime, Mike. It's night and day.
Yeah. Cal?
It's just steadily getting worse. It's on a parabolic curve of the tyranny is. It's on a curve of a parabola. It's just increasing exponentially each year. Actually, each month anymore.
Well, I was brought to think on that after I asked the question. I remember not too very long ago, maybe within the past year, I had this gentleman remind me on Facebook that he had spent 25 years of his life defending my freedoms in the United States military. And I said, well, I sure as hell hope you aren't being paid in retirement for doing that, because you have done a piss poor job because my freedoms have been decreasing the entire time you claim you were protecting them. I was blocked shortly thereafter. Resorting back to Brutus One, momentous then is the question you have to determine. And you are called upon by every motive which should influence a noble and virtuous mind to examine it well and to make up a wise judgment. Is it insisted indeed that this Constitution must be received, be it ever so imperfect? If it has its defects, it is said, they can best be amended when they are experienced. But remember, when the people once part with a power, they can seldom or never resume it again, but by force. Holy damn. Let me read that again. But remember, when the people once part with a power, they can seldom or never resume it again, but by force. People, please apply that to what has happened under this pandemic. You have parted with your powers, and they can seldom or never resume again but by force. Many instances can be produced in which the people have voluntarily increased the powers of their rulers, but few, if any, in which rulers have willingly abridged their authority. This is a sufficient reason to induce you to be careful, in the first instance, how you deposit the powers of government. With these few introductory remarks, I shall proceed to a consideration of this Constitution. Oh, okay, now Mr. Yates is going to take this Constitution and parse it for us. He said, the first question that presents itself on the subject is whether a confederated government be the best for the United States or not. Or in other words, whether the 13 United States should be reduced to one great republic, governed by one legislature and under the direction of one executive and judicial, or whether they should continue 13 confederated republics under the direction and control of a supreme federal head for certain defined national purposes only. Now, in Federalist 45, Mr. Madison told us that's what we were getting. 13 confederated republics under the direction and control of a supreme federal head for certain defined national purposes only, the promises of the Federalist. Yates goes on to say, this inquiry is important because although the government reported by the convention does not go to a perfect and entire consolidation, yet it approaches so near to it that it must, if executed, certainly and infallibly terminate in it. That's where we are today, a perfect, entire consolidation of the powers. The states have little to no powers. Continuing on, he says, this government is to possess absolute and uncontrollable power, legislative, executive, and judicial, with respect to every object to which it extends, for by the last clause of Section 8, Article 1, it is declared, and he quotes, that the Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or office thereof, unquote. And by the sixth article, it is declared, quote, that this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and the treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or law of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. It appears from these articles that there is no need of an intervention of state governments between the Congress and the people to execute any one power vested in the general government, and that the Constitution and laws of every state are nullified and declared void, so far as they are or shall be inconsistent with this Constitution, or the laws made in pursuance of it, or with treaties made under the authority of the United States. The government then, so far as it extends, is a complete one and not a confederation. It is as much one complete government as that of New York or Massachusetts, has as absolute and perfect powers to make and execute all laws, to appoint officers, institute courts, declare offensive and annex penalties with respect to every object to which it extends, as any other in the world. So far, therefore, as its powers reach, all ideas of confederation are given up and lost. It is true this government is limited to certain objects, or to speak more properly, some small degree of power is still left to the states, but a little attention to the powers vested in the general government will convince every candid man that if it is capable of being executed, all that is reserved for the individual states must very soon be annihilated so far as they are barely necessary to the organization of the general government. The powers of the general legislature extend to every case that is of the least importance. There is nothing valuable to human nature, nothing dear to free men, but what is within its power. It has the authority to make laws which will affect the lives, the liberty, and the property of every man in the United States. Nor can the Constitution or laws of any state in any way prevent or impede the full and complete execution of every power given. The legislative power is competent to lay duties, taxes, imposts, and excises. There is no limitation to this power. Think about that, KAH. Unless it be said that the clause which directs the use to which those taxes and duties shall be applied may be said to be a limitation, but this is no restriction of the power at all. For by this clause, they are to be applied to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But the legislature have authority to contract debts at their discretion. They are the sole judges of what is necessary to provide for the common defense, and they only are to determine what is for the general welfare. This power, therefore, is neither more nor less than a power to lay and collect taxes, imposts, and excises at their pleasure, not only the power to lay taxes unlimited as to the amount they may require, but it is perfect and absolute to raise them in any mode they please. You want to comment on that, Cal?
When you read this, it's just amazing that the Constitution was ratified, because that was one of the big contentions, was taxes what led to the revolution. And here they've just given in the Constitution those powers back to the crown, basically. Only it's just called the federal government now. This is, the government could do whatever it wants, and the power to tax is the power to destroy. So they've given the unlimited power to destroy the people's liberty back to a government. I don't see how people cannot not see that in what, you know, when you have somebody articulate the Constitution in what it's saying, when you take the legalese out of the Constitution and look at the plain text of it, this is exactly what it's saying. There's unlimited power to tax for whatever they want. Whatever those guys back there in Washington, D.C. decide to do, they can do constitutionally. They can just say it's constitutional, and they can do it. And that's what's happening. That's about all I got for that.
Well, you know, he points out, although we have people who are constitutional attorneys on several fronts who tell us that the Constitution does not give unlimited taxing powers, and I've always been amazed that so many of the anti-federalists point this out unequivocally, as Brutus just did, that the power to tax is unlimited. There is no restraint whatsoever.
And that fact is never denied by the Federalists in the Federalist Papers. No. In fact, Federalist 23, Hamilton admits it.
Mm-hmm.
Hamilton admits it. Yeah, we need to have this power to unlimited tax because we don't know what future exigencies the Union might become up against. So we need to have this power in reserve always.
Exactly.
That's what it says. And people accepted it and ratified it. It just...
Well, you know, Cal, I've had people ask me when I've given programs and what have you, and they have asked me, well, how did they ever get this thing ratified? Well, you know, there's some good stories about that. Well, number one, you know, the day that the Constitution was signed, it was immediately carried from one building in Philadelphia to another building, and they tried to ram the ratification through the state of Pennsylvania within hours of it being released. It hadn't even been sent from the Congress yet. And there was a move in Philadelphia by the Federalists, and it turned out to be a strong arm measure. There were people who said, no, this ain't going to work. We're not going to ratify this without reading it, without examining it. It should be examined. It should be looked at. You know, they didn't fall for the Nancy Pelosi approach. Let's ratify this thing, find out what's in it. They did not want to do that, especially the people from Western Pennsylvania were fighting against ratification. And so several of them, to prevent a vote from taking place, just would not show up, so there wouldn't be a quorum. So the sergeant at arms actually sent out people to grab these delegates, and some of them were beaten and forcibly carried back into the convention hall. And by that time, enough of the other people thought to themselves, well, hey, if you're going to have to beat people to get them to accept this, no, we're not going to accept it either. So they kind of, messed up their own nest with that move, but they forcibly tried to bring people back to vote on this without ever reading it. Delaware, if you look at their license tags today, says the first state. Well, they should be the stupid ass state, because they ratified to be first. They ratified the Constitution without ever reading it. And several of the conventions, it was brought up. Georgia did the same thing. They ratified it without reading it. And Thomas Jefferson himself, when he began to see what was happening, his proposal was that Virginia and Massachusetts and New York should stay out intentionally, not ratify it. So Jefferson began to see some of the things here, you know, and he said, well, we should stay out. And Patrick Henry believed the same thing. If we can just get Virginia and New York not to ratify, we can force them to make some serious changes. Of course, then you get to the Virginia ratification, and Patrick Henry is trying his best to stop ratification. James Madison is running around promising everybody, if you will just ratify this, we will give you a Bill of Rights. We'll let you have amendments. We'll do all of this amendment stuff. And he staked his political career on, and he got it ratified in Virginia by promising amendments. So it was huge, and it is kind of weird when you look at it. But, you know, if you go back and look at some other things, at the University of Virginia archives, there is proof that the Federalists put false letters into newspapers. Imagine that. They were messing with the news media back then. They put false letters, like from people like Daniel Shays. And Daniel Shays was blamed because of his, the Shays Rebellion was blamed for, and you know what those guys were doing? They were resisting taxes. Isn't that why we fought the damn Revolutionary War? To resist taxes? Any comments, Dave?
To resist taxes and to try to get out of the stranglehold that Bank of England represented. But of course, you know, we had the infiltrator Alexander Hamilton, you know, pushing us right back into the original problem. It's really quite incredible. And that struggle goes on today, doesn't it?
Well, you know, something was brought up to me this morning, and it was something I had thought of before, but it's really something that needs to be looked at, and I'm hoping we can do it on a future program. If we look at the Declaration of Independence, and I think it's the third paragraph, is what I called a criminal indictment against George III and the government of England. And what I would like to do on a future program, guys, is to take that indictment in paragraph 3 and compare that with what this government is doing today. And I believe that we can prove that the reasons that the Americans wanted to separate from England, that the government of King George III has been replaced by this government under this constitution. Any thoughts?
This government's worse. We'd be better off under the crown.
Well, you know what the tax rate...
In a lot of respects, because at least then you have one focus of what, you know, if there's just a monarch and there's tyranny, well, okay, blame the monarch, but now who do you... I mean, you're talking 535 Congress critters and 9 guys in black robes. So who do you blame? Oh, yeah, add in a president, too, or a king or a president, whichever one you want to call him.
Same thing.
Yeah.
What was it Patrick Henry said? Away with your president, we shall have a king?
Yeah. What do you think executive orders are?
Somebody tell me today how Joe Biden has not assumed the powers of a king. And somebody tell me that Donald Trump wasn't the same thing. He called on all kinds of things he didn't have the authority to do. But of course, if you polarize the people into Democrats and Republicans, Republicans will gladly authorize usurpations of the Constitution as long as it's their guy who's doing it. And the vice versa is also true. Okay, it's okay if our guy violates the Constitution. It's okay. Or if our guy is violating our constitutional rights, it's because he's playing 4D chess. And you're too damn dumb to see it, was basically what I was told when I brought up, let's take the guns first, due process second. And I brought up another fact yesterday, guys, and we can expound on this a little bit if you like. I brought this up on another program, is that I believe if when you stop and look at this whole pandemic, including masks, vaccinations, shutdowns, everything, has been supported by both political parties. Because what did we have? Well, with Mr. Trump, we had Operation Warp Speed, which Warp Speed meant, let's get you this vaccine before it is thoroughly tested on anything. That's what it equated to. But nobody wants to mention that now who supports the Republicans. And did, let me see, who put Fauci in charge of this stuff?
Fauci's been in charge since, I think, what, 1981?
Right. And Reagan, why, man. If Fauci was off the rails, why didn't Trump fire him?
Yeah. And even Governor DeSantis, with all of his, opening of the state, which is great, he's not challenged the vaccine. And I don't think any leader in the entire world has, other than the guy in Belarus and what's the other country in Africa? Tanzania. Of course, he's dead now. And the new president, a female, is 100% on board with vaccination and the whole deal.
Of course she is. Mike, this has been kind of like a relay race, and everybody just watched a perfect baton toss from Trump to Biden in this race towards despotism.
Well, you know, again, and I brought this up, and pardon my redundancy, but the true reflection of Republican, conservative, some of whom call themselves Christians, the true reflection of these people, I believe, can be contrasted within a two-month period. Because in November of 2020, right before the election, if you would have canvassed all of those people who are Republicans, who voted Republican, who were staunchly for Trump, if you could have polled all of them and said, would you accept a military dictatorship as a form of government? I promise you, overwhelmingly, it would have been rejected. 2 months later, in January, after the election fraud, obvious election fraud, after all of that was done, if you would have asked those same Republicans, would you accept a military dictatorship if Trump was the dictator? They would have said, not no, but hell yes. Bring it on. I heard them saying that. I heard good folks I had a lot of confidence in before that. People I felt like were just, you know, they were supporting Trump because he wasn't Hillary. I thought that they had a better viewpoint. But I heard many of them saying, oh, I hope Q's right. I hope this is going to happen. Man, I just can't wait. Trump comes in, military tribunal. We'll arrest all these people. We'll hang them. And they were ready to accept the Bolshevik revolution in America as long as Donald Trump was leading it. You guys see any significance in that?
That just shows how effective the powers of be are in their indoctrination and propaganda and manipulating the people. These guys are good at what they do.
Yeah. And Mike, as you've observed in the past, if Hillary Clinton had been running the show during COVID, you know, telling people to wear masks and take the vaccine, just imagine the fallout, what it would have been amongst the conservative crowd. But with Trump in office, most people seem to think, this must be real. Trump's telling us so.
Well, exactly, Dave. And I believe that from the get-go. I thought, you know, in a PSYOP, if I'm operating a PSYOP, I'm going to look at the people most likely to oppose my operation. And I think that is a valid assessment by any authority that's ever run a PSYOP. And our government is one constant PSYOP. So if you go, okay, who we're going to bring out this pandemic in 2020? We've got it in the plans because we've talked about it. Even Fauci mentioned it in 2017. Trump takes office. Not in the same year, Fauci says, well, in 2020, Trump will be faced with a pandemic. Well, how did he know? You know, and then we've got a Law and Order show in 2012 where they're faced with a COVID pandemic in New York City. They tease your mind with these things, and so the idea is implanted. But in a psychological operation, you have to assess before you begin it, where is my opposition going to come from? Because that's the critical point. Where will my opposition be? And so you go, okay, all right. My opposition will come from the Christian conservative right. They are the people most likely to stand up and say no, and they could ruin our entire operation. So how do I get the people to accept this? Well, I take, as Cal has said, if you want to control the opposition, you lead the opposition. So you create a cult figure. How do you create this cult figure? Well, it's pretty simple. From day one, or before he's ever inaugurated, while he's running for president, you just blast him every day. You can't turn on CNN, PMS, NBC, CBS, NBC, Fox. You can't turn on anything without somebody is criticizing Trump. That solidifies his position with the people. That is a psyop. If I want these people to really adhere to this guy, I get the people they hate to criticize him on a daily basis. So you've got Anderson Cooper, Rachel Maddow. You've got all of these loonies criticizing Trump on a daily basis. One indictment after another. You try to impeach him twice. It's nothing but a constant barrage. What you do is you solidify his support. So you've got his support solidified. These people would ride into hell for the orange man. So then when the pandemic comes, who's in charge? Who says, oh, we need to wear masks? We need to social distance. Oh, we need to shut down businesses. Oh, yes. Okay, we need to do this. Warp speed. We're going to need a vaccine. Warp speed. Let's get one out there. I'll put the military in charge of getting that thing out there. Let's get a vaccine right now. The opposition has been controlled, mind controlled, because their guy, their hero, the criticized man, the guy that doesn't have a chance, the guy who is criticized for everything he does, and he's trying to drain the swamp. So everybody accepts him, no matter what he says. Hey, if he wants to be a military dictator, we'll take him. You know, we wouldn't have liked Stalin in that position. We wouldn't have liked Hitler in that position, but we'll take Trump as a military dictator.
Well, Mike, it's interesting too how from the very beginning the only solution was a vaccine. And you know, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, any other possible therapy, even vitamin C IV treatment, which is highly effective against all kinds of disease, that was not permissible. It was declared quackery. And of course, the whole concept of lockdowns originated in China. And for some reason, the entire world decided that was the only way forward.
Well, Dave, in the very beginning, how long did Trump tell us it would take us to flatten the curve?
2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks and we'll flatten the curve. Well,
it's been a long 2 weeks, Mike.
Yeah, it's been a long 2 weeks. Exactly. But my theory of the PSYOP and how they use Trump, Cal, shoot holes in that for me, please.
Oh, there are no holes. They actually put out tests to see how well it was effective. I mean, Trump came out and said, I could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and my supporters would still support me. He came out and said, you need to grab him by the pussy, and his supporters still supported him. He said, take the guns first, due process later. And his supporters still supported him. So they continually test how effective their guy is in manipulating the people, in leading the opposition. They continually test him, and he continually tests how well he can convince these people. He's been he's better than P.T. Barnum at what he's done.
Well, you know, here's the other thing, too. Stop and think about this. If Hillary Clinton would have said, take the guns first, due process second, how many Republicans would have said, it's okay, guys, she's just playing 4D chess?
Well, what if Biden said it now? Exactly. I'm just waiting for him to say I'm just waiting for him to say something like that to see what their response is.
Well, see, here's the thing. That shows you that the PSYOP is complete when people who claim to support freedom, who claim to support liberty, when they would accept complete and total tyranny as long as their guy was in charge. I can remember saying back in the 80s and 90s, hell, the Republicans would vote for Hitler if he ran as a good Republican. And people would say, that'll never happen. Nobody's going to do that. Nobody would ever do that. Well, it's not the person. See, that's what they've been able to do. They have convinced the people who call themselves conservative Republicans in this country to accept tyranny as long as they like the guy who's driving the bus.
That's cult of personality. Classic.
That is such a triumph for a psyop. I mean, these guys have to be high-fiving each other all over the place. But, again, the principle of the psyop is find out who your opposition is going to be and convert your opposition to accept your psyop. Because you know the dumbasses are going to accept it. You know, whatever that goofy guy was about gun control, David, whatever his name was, and the stupid climate control teenager. What was her name?
David Hogg.
Yeah, David Hogg. And what was the girl's name? What was the girl's name that's the climate control from Norway or whatever her name is?
I forget her name, yeah.
Well, you know that those people are going to accept it. Because they're already mind controlled. You don't worry about the people that's already on your team. That is why Hitler, in his 1938 Gun Control Act, that's why Hitler did not take the guns from the members of the Nazi Party. He made sure he took everybody else's guns. But you don't take the guns of the people who support you. Because they're not going to oppose what you do. So you don't care whether they're armed or not. The only people you want to disarm are the people you're afraid that will catch on to your scheme and shoot your ass. That's the only people you want to disarm. So, Dave, what do you think about where we're going here? What do you see? If you had to sit down today and write a script for where we will be a year from now, what would it be?
Well, that's a good question. I think what's going to happen is we're going to have an endless barrage of new variants and new super mutated forms of COVID, probably related directly to these vaccines, but the dots will never be connected for the general public. And I just think we're going to keep spiraling down into this morass of medical tyranny as long as people are willing to go along with it. If people won't go along with it, the whole thing ends overnight.
Well, I couldn't say that better. And thanks to a listener, the lady's name was Greta.
Yeah, Thunberg.
Yeah. And one of those brilliant people, you know, who, yeah. But Dave, I've got a theory. And I know how these psyops work. I actually was involved in a few of them, not in the U.S., so. But I know how these psyops are intended to work. What you always have with your main psyop is you have Plan B, Plan C, and Plan D in case Bubis begins to catch on to your plan. So you can shift right into another plan. If Bubis begins to catch on. So you take them right back into the panic state. So what do you see being the next panic where we've got to go into panic here?
Well, yeah. They always have contingency plans, no question. Well, they're certainly lining the pieces up on the chessboard for a possible World War III. It's amazing how, you know, the media keeps saying that Russia is aggressively moving forces to the Ukrainian border. What they're really doing, Russia's moving its troops around within its own country, yet they're calling that aggression. Meanwhile, NATO is moving up war games literally kilometers away from the Russian border, you know, and here they're pushing Turkey into the arms of Russia and China and Iran. So they're creating sort of, you know, the Allies and the evil empire kind of scenario here for a possible World War III. If somehow the COVID narrative falls apart, I think that's the next shoe to drop if they have to go there.
Well, let's drop back almost 60 years ago to 1962, Dave. Let's draw back to an analogy. America goes absolutely batshit crazy because we find out that the Russians have missiles in Cuba. Remember that crisis?
I wasn't alive then, but I'm familiar with it, yes.
Oh, I forgot. You're just a pup.
Yeah.
So we have the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962, and the great headlines. And I remember the panic. I mean, it was almost sheer panic. Everybody thought we were going to war. And so we've got this, the Russians have missiles only 90 miles from our shore. You know, gosh, we've got to do something. We can't tolerate this. Does anybody know that at the same time in Turkey, we had ICBMs 50 miles from the Russian border?
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's amazing, too. Ukraine's even said that we're preparing for war with Russia. Well, that's like, you know, hey, my big brother's going to come beat you up in the schoolyard if you don't leave me alone. I mean, it's absurd.
Well, let's go back a little bit, Dave, and I'm trying to think of her name. I can see her face, Victoria something. Maybe one of my listeners can help me out with this.
Nuland.
Yeah, Victoria Nuland. Remember the government she helped place in Ukraine?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They overthrew the government essentially with one of those colored revolutions. Right. They actually used Nazis, far right extremists, so to speak, to get it going, and they even shot people using government snipers to inflame the whole situation.
And she got caught on a actual audio of admitting that, didn't she?
Absolutely. And they even admitted they spent $5 billion to stir this whole mess up. It's incredible.
And Victoria Nuland, who was her husband?
Kagan. She's married to Robert Kagan, one of the insiders from the PNAC group and from the Kagan family, which if you look into their background, just an absolutely diabolical, evil family going back generations.
Imagine that. So Kagan helps install a Nazi government in the Ukraine. And they were Nazis. They admitted they were Nazis. And that's a good thing.
It's staggering. And here we are meddling with, in Russia's backyard. But Russia's the aggressor. It's quite incredible.
Well, you know what? What's the importance of the Ukraine, Dave?
Well, I think a good part of it is that it was known as the breadbasket for Russia, and I think it was to weaken Russia's food source and to create a problem for them, right, literally in their backyard.
Well, what about Sevastopol? Is that not the Russian army's only warm water port during their harsh winters?
That's exactly right. And of course, you know, that was actually part of Russia until what, the 1952, 53?
Correct. Absolutely.
And if you look at what a sad state Ukraine is, Ukraine has been turned into a third world country. Extreme poverty. And really no reason for it whatsoever. All this meddling has really actually hurt the people of the country.
Oh, big time. Cal, did you go to sleep on us, buddy?
No, just listening to what's the exchange there and enjoying every bit of it. It's, yeah, it is funny how Russia or China or Iran even are the aggressors. You know, the recent reports of little aluminum Iranian gunboats, little skiffs, are harassing big old Coast Guard cutters, which happened to be off the coast of Iran for some reason. Yeah. I thought the Coast Guard was to guard the coast of the United States, and I didn't know we were over there. I guess we are, though. We are a federal empire, so we have a lot of bases around Iran, so I guess it's part of us anyway. U.S. homogeny, go USA, yay.
Yeah, what is the Coast Guard doing in Iran's backyard? It's no one's asked that question. That's a good point, Cal.
Harassing other countries. That's what we do. That's what this country does. We're forcing the U.S. hegemony on everybody.
Go back to the PSYOP, gentlemen, and the point about accepting anything Trump does because he's your guy. Let's transpose that thing into America is your country, so America can perform criminal acts on other countries, and it's okay because it's our country. Isn't that what we just described?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when Japan did limited engagement, no boots on the ground, and attacked Pearl Harbor, that was considered an act of war, wasn't it? They militarily attacked the United States territory. Yeah. How many times has this government, Trump, twice, didn't he lob missiles into Syria?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be an act of war? When he this was a new one, when he admittedly assassinated that Iranian general. I mean, before this was always done covertly. I mean, yeah, you know that the United States has assassinated people through the CIA and everything, but he openly admitted, yeah, I sent a missile after him, blew his ass up. You don't openly assassinate other generals of other countries. What if another country assassinated one of the generals here? What would the response be? It just blows me away.
Well, but it's us. It's just like the Republicans are going, oh, well, we'll take a military dictatorship as long as the orange man's in charge. So it's this perverted sense that we have. Guys, I remember, I think it was 2008 or 2009. I was writing for a libertarian website, and I wrote an article in which I said that, why do we fear Iran and their weapons program? Why do we fear North Korea? Why do we fear other countries and say, hey, they have no right to have nuclear weapons when we have them and when our allies have them? But we're saying other countries do not have the right to have these weapons. And what I did was I made the analogy that is exactly why, the very same reason is exactly why Americans believe in the Second Amendment. We should have the weapons and the means to protect ourselves from a criminal government. And my article said, well, shouldn't other countries have that same right? It's obvious our government is criminal. And we've just described why. Should other countries not have the right to defend themselves from this criminal government? And what's the difference? Ironically, that was around, I said, 2008, 2009. I get a phone call, first an email, and then a phone call from a representative of the NRA. And they had a radio program at that time out of Falls Church, Virginia. So the lady who called me said, look, we would like to have you to come on our sponsored radio program, and we would like to have you come on and talk about your article. And I said, really? And they said, yes, you're equating foreign countries with our rights, that the people have a right to own firearms to protect themselves from a corrupt government, and you're saying that our enemies have that same right. And I said, sure, I'll be happy to come on and discuss it with you. Well, I guess they got their heads together and they started thinking about this. I got a call back the next day and said, well, we're sorry, that show's been canceled. Because I believe they did not want to make that public. Because shouldn't other countries have the right to defend themselves from the same government we think we ought to have a right to defend ourselves from? Is my thoughts Looney Tunes there, Dave, or do I have a point?
Oh, yeah, no, that's a great point. And you know, look what they're doing in Afghanistan. The Biden administration broke the agreement that they were going to be out by this month. Instead, they changed it till September 11th. And somehow, you know, if the Afghan people somehow resist this and want the army out, it's terrorism. And now we're supposed to worry about, oh, they're going to crack down on the freedom of women in Afghanistan. Well, maybe they will, but it's not our country. And somehow they're trying to tug on the heartstrings that they're going to take away makeup from women and not allow them to do this or that. And somehow that's going to justify us keeping our troops there and definitely, you know, meddling in their culture and the way they want to have their civilization.
Well, that's the American arrogance. And when I was in foreign countries, and you're in one now, Dave, what we consider a foreign country, I don't know how many times that I heard about the arrogance of Americans, France, Germany, other places, about the arrogance of the Americans who believe they have rights that other people don't have. Is that a viable complaint, guys?
No, the United States is definitely guilty of arrogance of power. Most definitely. And that's what's led to all these conflicts all around the globe, is the arrogance of the American populace. Bubus Americanus and his ignorance and arrogance. That arrogance is what leads to the ignorance, too.
Well, yeah, I said about all of the goodwill that we wasted, because right after 9/11, you know, how many places did we hear have these countries saying, hey, we're all Americans now? We're, you know, and we had a lot of people, and then we quickly squandered that. Of course, you know, we did our own 9/11. You can like it or not like it. It's up, you know, the evidence is irrefutable. You know, you can believe fairy tales if you want to. Doesn't bother me at all. But it's just a weird, and, you know, I have thought many times, what will America look like in the history books if the planet survives? What will America look like in the history books 100 years from now? Any thoughts on that, Dave?
Well, I think it depends on who becomes top dog. If America and its allies are still running the show, it'll be the greatest country ever to exist or to exist in the future. And but if not, I think the truth will come out that, unfortunately, the country has been meddling in the affairs of other countries and trying to dictate a unipolar way of thinking that really should not exist. People should have the right to create their own countries and their own civilizations.
Totally agree. Dave, we're running down on time here. Would you please tell the folks about your program and your time slot? And maybe what you have planned for tomorrow?
Well, yes, tomorrow, you know, my show comes on Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A. And I'm going to have this guy on there called the Rebel Madman, along with Daryl Wayne and a guy, Dale, from Salt Lake City, I believe. And we're going to just have a conversation about world affairs and history and see where it takes us. I think it'll be a very interesting journey.
Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to that as well. I know the other two men you mentioned on there, I know them quite well, and I know they will definitely uphold their end of the conversation. I think that it will be a absolutely great show, Dave, and I look forward to it.
Well,
Cal, what's going on in the, did you want to say something else?
No, I was just going to say, you had Dale on your show last Sunday, and it was just fantastic. Dale is certainly a very well-informed man.
That he is, quite so. Well, you want to tell us about the great events in Arizona there, Cal, before we run out of time?
It's just getting hot out here in Arizona. That's all that's happening out here.
All right. Well, I'm going to pack up and move out there with you shortly.
Well, you're more than welcome to come here. I got a hookups.
Well, I appreciate that, buddy. I'm not sure I'm going to come in the heat of summer, though.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it, but there is an awning to cover your trailer. But yeah, I wouldn't recommend it. It does get hot.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for everyone for listening in. We appreciate it. Come back and visit with us again soon.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We talk about